Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information, as well as podcasts of past programs. I'm Lisa Alaferis, health editor for KQED News and your moderator for tonight's program. We also welcome our listeners on radio, television, and the internet. Tonight's program is part of the club's series in ethics and accountability underwritten by the Charles Travers family. This program is being held in association with the club's Health and Medicine Forum. Our focus tonight is improving the ethics and practice of medicine. As provisions of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, come into play, how concerned should we be about patient-doctor relationships, hospital practices, confidentiality, fees, and humane treatment? Is healthcare about to get better than it has ever been, or is the sword of Damocles about to be lowered? Ultimately, what actions can both medical providers and patients take to ensure the best care going forward? Tonight, you'll hear from a high-level group of doctors about how medical professionals can better treat patients and increase the quality of healthcare. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished panelists. First, Dr. Robert Pearl is Executive Director and CEO of the Permanente Medical Group. As CEO of the largest medical group in the country, comprising more than 7,000 physicians and 25,000 staff members across 21 medical centers in Northern California, Dr. Pearl is responsible for the healthcare of over 3 million Kaiser Permanente members. In addition, he's the president and CEO of the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group, providing care to 500,000 Kaiser Permanente members in Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. Board certified in plastic and reconstructive surgery, Dr. Pearl currently serves on the faculty at Stanford University, both at the medical center and the business school, where he teaches courses on strategy, leadership, and healthcare technology. Dr. Pearl, welcome.
Thank you.
Next to him is Dr. Victoria Sweet. She is professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and a prize-winning historian with a PhD in medical history. She practiced medicine for 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco. In her recent book, God's Hotel, A Doctor, A Hospital, and A Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine, she lays out evidence in stories of her patients and her hospital for some new ideas about medicine and healthcare in this country. In trying to get control of healthcare costs by emphasizing efficiency, Sweet says we've headed down a wrong path. She says that medicine works best, that is, arrives at the right diagnosis and the right treatment for the least cost, when the doctor has enough time to do a good job and pays attention not only to the patient, but also what's around the patient. Dr. Sweet calls this approach slow medicine. The New York Times calls her ideas hardcore subversion. Vanity Fair judges the book to be a radical and compassionate alternative to modern healthcare. Dr. Sweet, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Josh Adler. Dr. Adler is Chief Medical Officer of the University of California San Francisco Medical Center and UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital. As Chief Medical Officer, he oversees the quality, safety, and effectiveness of medical care, as well as the integration of patient care, education, and research. Prior to taking his current position as Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Adler served for 7 years as the Medical Director of Ambulatory Care at UCSF. Dr. Adler also previously served as Assistant Chief of Medicine and Chief Medical Officer of the 6th Hospital Sierra Pacific Veterans Administration Network. Dr. Adler is a practicing internist and professor of clinical medicine at UCSF. Dr. Adler, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So please welcome our panelists, everyone. Thank you. So I'm going to start with an opening question for each panelist. We've arrived at a singular juncture in American medicine, with the biggest expansion of healthcare in this country in 50 years, speeding toward us courtesy of the Affordable Care Act. At the same time, American medicine is rife with challenges. At the most basic level, when compared against other developed countries, America is at or near the bottom for lifespan, infant mortality, and deaths from non-communicable diseases. Against that backdrop, I'd like each of you to explain what you think is meant by ethics in medicine and name one or two of the most pressing challenges you see in medical ethics, not just for doctors, but for all people working in the vast, sprawling, and fragmented healthcare system today. And Dr. Adler, I'd like you to begin, please.
Thank you. Well, that's a terrific starting question. And I'd like to begin by framing it around some age-old medical ethical principles and the fact that the current state challenges some of those and broadens them. So the first is the principle of do no harm, which is an age-old principle in the care of patients and really refers to not proceeding with the treatment unless it's likely to help, because if it's not likely to help, we certainly wouldn't want to do anything wrong. But since 1998, when the Institute of Medicine published its seminal work on patient safety, we know that, in fact, a large amount of harm can come to patients in the conduct of care that is actually supposed to be beneficial. So the challenge to us ethically is being able to, one, minimize harm, which I think American medicine is proceeding on. We have a very long way to go, but we've certainly made progress. But assuming that we can't minimize or eliminate all harm, we have to consider the potential harm and benefit that will accrue with any particular intervention that a patient may undergo. So that's really a new wrinkle to this age-old principle. The second is a principle of justice, which originally had its core at being fair, that all patients should be treated fairly. And in many ways, this had to do with equity, that people would be treated the same no matter where they come from, whether they could pay, or what their social makeup. But in the state we're in the United States and in the world, around the cost of health care, there's a new wrinkle to justice, and it has to do with the appropriate stewardship of a limited resource to a population and how that intersects with the care of an individual patient. So I think this is an important, a critically important principle, because we don't have unlimited resources, and whether those are dollars or doctors or nurses or technicians or hospital beds, we have to come up with the best possible distribution of those resources so we do the greatest good for the greatest number.
Okay, Josh Adler, thank you. Victoria Sweet.
So when I sat down this morning, actually, to think about these things, and I started by asking myself this first question: what does medical ethics mean to me? Since I was I'm a historian as well as a doc, I had to look up the etymology of ethics, which is Greek, ethike, and originally comes from the word ethos, which in Greek means character or disposition. And I take that to mean that something interesting, and that is, we get ethics from our innate character, what's easiest for us to do, what feels right. That's ethos, ethics comes out of what feels actually right to do. So it implies a natural human goodness, a kind of altruism, an innate inclination to be ethical, to do the right thing. So usually, not just for me, it means doing the ethics are the general principles by which I decide what to do and what not to do in any particular situation. And in medicine, a lot of work has gone into classifying ethical principles. For instance, there's the principle of beneficence, of providing benefit to the patient, doing good. And then there's the principle of autonomy, that is, the patient's right to it comes from the Greek autos, meaning self. It means the patient's right to decide. And one of the things for me that is so difficult about ethics in medicine is that in so many places, end-of-life care, confidentiality and privacy, even diagnosis and treatment, these ethical principles are in conflict. So it's not a clear situation of evil versus good usually, but of good versus good. So for instance, let me give you for instance, the principle of beneficence, doing good to a patient, clashing with the principle of autonomy. Somebody doesn't want to do what does them good. Right? Happens all the time. And then whose good shall prevail? The patients, the societies, the hospitals. And this leads me to the second part of this question, which is what I think is the most pressing challenge today, not only for me as a doctor, but for everyone involved in the healthcare system, although I can only talk here as a doctor. And that is the conflict implicit in the suddenly new roles that I as a doctor have, which is to not only be a doctor to my patient, but to be this thing called a steward of the nation's healthcare resources, as one recent economist put it in a New England Journal article, and in addition, to be a loyal healthcare employee to my healthcare employer. I can't begin to tell you how stressful these three often opposing ethical imperatives are for a doctor. My fundamental Hippocratic duty, which I swore to when I graduated medical school and which I believe in, is to enter the house of the sick only for the benefit of the sick. It's a person-to-person contract. So, for instance, if I determine that my patient is best served by having an expensive test or medication, that is what I'm ethically supposed to provide. But these days, I'm also expected to be a careful steward of society's healthcare resources, which should mean that before I order that expensive test, I take into account not just what is best for my patient, but what is best for the healthcare system as a whole, the nation's budget, our public health. So what do I do if my patient is old or disabled, or one of the bad boys or bad girls I had so many of at Laguna Honda and the county? Not a gainfully employed, contributing member of society, and not ever likely to be one. Should I order that expensive test? Wouldn't that money be better spent on public health measures to raise America's standing against the measures of lifespan, infant mortality, and deaths from non-communicable diseases? But in addition, there's my new ethical duty towards my employer, a hospital or a healthcare company these days, who, if it's created one of the new accountable care organizations in the Obamacare Act, let's call it, stands to lose quite a bit of money if I order that expensive test. And I have the obligation, and it has to some extent the right, I have the obligation of helping it continue as a going concern. So what do I as an ethical doctor do? That's the challenge that I see from this seat.
Victoria Sweet, thank you. Robert Pearl.
Thank you, Lisa. As I think about ethics, my perspective is that it's a set of rules that allow us to do the right thing, and that they're built upon a moral framework, but they serve best as a compass, particularly, as Victoria said, when there's competing points of view and not a single right answer. I think that ethics are essential in times of change, and that's what's happening today in American healthcare. You asked about two potentially crucial issues, not just for physicians, but for the entire society. The first one that comes to my mind is, how are we as a nation, how are we as care deliverers going to respond to the forces out of Washington, D.C., out of businesses, out of individuals, to lower the cost of healthcare? There are some who believe that the solutions must involve two-tier systems, rationing, or cutbacks. It's my belief that ethically that's not the right answers. That the right solutions from an ethical perspective will require that we restructure American healthcare, that we move from a system rewarding volume to one that focuses on outcomes, that we start to value prevention as the best means not only of making patients healthy, but of being able to reduce the cost, that we focus on patient safety, make sure we get it right the first time. And these will be very disruptive. These changes will fundamentally alter how physicians practice and how patients receive care. But I think from an ethical perspective, they're the right answer to the very complex question that faces us today. The second area is that of the pernicious relationship between the for-profit drug and device companies and doctors. And we in Kaiser Permanente have come down very strong on it from what we believe to be the ethical perspective. It's simply inappropriate and wrong. That it violates the fundamental principles. Anytime not only a physician does it, but even has the perception that he or she might be putting his or her personal finances ahead of the greater good of the particular patient. And I think that that's an ethical stand that we need to take as an entire nation. I'll be very interested in hearing what the other panelists think.
Well, Robert Pearl, I find that very interesting, these two areas that you've laid out, because I think there's actually there may be a fundamental connection there. So you stated your concerns around the pernicious relationship between doctors and device companies and pharmaceutical companies as well. And it all dovetails with a question I have here from the audience, which is, how can a patient be sure that her doctor has no vested interest in testing machinery, facilities, hospitals, pharmaceuticals, et cetera? So obviously it's top of mind for patients. But I'd also say that, is there a connection also between a doctor's commitment, how doctors are reimbursed with fee-for-service medicine, a system that rewards volume? So the money is always in the room, even if it's not in the form. Would you say the money is always in the room, even if it's not in the form of a company and a relationship with the doctor?
I think money and ethics often are used in the same sentence. So there's definitely a relationship, or at least some issues around both of those together. I think to the question that the audience posed, first of all, I think patients need to ask. I think physicians actually have a moral responsibility. They don't yet have a legal one, but I think they should, to disclose that they have a certain relationship with a drug or a device company. And what we know, as an example, is that those physicians who are being paid by companies that produce spinal fusion devices use a lot more of them. Is that coincidence? Is that not? Each patient will need to decide, but that's the facts that sit in place. At the federal level, they actually will be publishing the names of physicians in the future, and I think that's information that patients absolutely need to have. And you're also right that the financials, I teach at the business school, so the financial systems change behavior. That's the fundamental belief that they teach at Stanford Business School. Mm-hmm. And so within all of that, the question becomes, if you have a fee-for-service system, what are people likely to do? And how do we make sure that, underlying that ethically, to the point that Dr. Sweet made, that the right thing is done for the patient, both from the standpoint of providing the right care and making sure that it's being done for the best interest of the patient?
I'll just throw out a little plug here for some of my colleagues at ProPublica, who, that's a foundation-funded journalism, and they have put together Dollars for Doctors. They have a database where you can look up an individual doctor and see if that doctor has a relationship with any, is receiving money from any company. So I don't know who posed that question, but if you want to check that out, you can. Victoria Sweet, you're the doctor who's practicing the most frequently on this panel, and I'm wondering if I would guess that you don't think that there are forces in the room compelling you to do certain things, but I'm wondering how you respond as a practicing physician.
Well, I have to confess that since this book came out, I have not been practicing for about the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. It's been an amazing experience, but so I'm coming from a little bit before that. There are pressures on doctors, but both ways. Fee-for-service has obvious pressures, and I have to say I've never known a doctor that I've worked with who particularly had that as a compelling decision. But I think that it works both ways, because you can also be paid not to order a test. And that's the opposite part of this scale. If you're in an affordable care organization, the HMOs, you're looked at very carefully. You're pressured not to necessarily order a more expensive medication that perhaps you use once a day because it's more expensive. So I think that the ethical issues of payment go both ways. I don't know the answer, though, to the question that's often on my mind, which is, I mean, as a doc, I look at who's getting pressure, and it looks to me like it's the politicians. I mean, honestly, why aren't the pharmas being controlled? I mean, is it really that some little doc someplace gets a pen and orders orders a medicine rather than a different medicine, or is it the millions of dollars in lobbying money? Because if you look at our country versus most other countries, that is one of the fundamental differences, is the cost of individual drugs. And I'll just give one example that really stuck in my mind. I think it was today or yesterday's New York Times talked about they've discovered a wonderful new drug for multiple sclerosis. It's dimethyl fumarate, which apparently has been used on sofas for decades. Now, you would think that a medicine that's been used on sofas for decades would be inexpensive. But now that they've found out it's good for multiple sclerosis, they're going to be charging $50,000 a year for the sofa, the sofa medicine. So if we really want to get the culprit, I think that is a more generalized culprit, if you will, that I would like to see looked at least as much as the fee-for-service. And that's not, I've never had to work in a fee-for-service. I've had the luxury of getting paid a salary. And that has been a wonderful thing. I don't have to deal with it. I worked at Laguna Honda, I worked at the county. I just had to fight to get the patient, my patient what they needed, and I didn't have to worry about getting more or less paid, and that was one of the reasons I did that kind of work.
So, Josh Adler, you're so Robert Pearl is with Kaiser Permanente, which has already dealt with the issue of moving beyond fee-for-service medicine. But you're at one of the premier medical institutions in this country. And how disruptive has the change been so far, just since the first wave of managed care in the 90s and now today with the Affordable Care Act?
Before I answer that, let me just address the general notion of is fee-for-service different than prepayment? And since I've worked both in the VA system, which was really a prepayment endeavor, and in a fee-for-service system in the last 15 years, I can say they are different. That despite the fact that, in fact, in my case, we're all the same physicians. They're all UCSF faculty at the San Francisco VA and at the Maine Medical Center. Although I believe we all try to practice the same, because the forces are slightly different, I do believe care is slightly different. I don't know which is better, but I do believe that fee-for-service does versus prepayment does change the equation a little bit, and probably in some cases
enough. Can you give us some examples?
Here's an example. So if you were to perhaps you would sit at a place like the VA and you may have the endocrinologist, the diabetes doctor, sitting around thinking about how best to manage the couple hundred patients who have diabetes. Which tests should we order? How often? Which medication should we use? In those discussions, considerations of what are our total resources? What makes the most sense? Do we need to order a test every 3 months, or should we do it every 6 months? How often should the patient come back in? And in that conversation is the notion of what is our total resource investment into that care. If you have that same conversation at a place that practices in fee-for-service, where in fact with each test, or with each test, for example, there might be income, and with each medication, at least there's no direct expense accrued to that institution, you may get a different answer. You may say, well, I think maybe testing a little more frequently is better care. I think maybe using this particular drug is slightly better. Even though it's quite a bit more expensive, it's not my expense. So the point being, I actually don't know which one, whether each one or the other delivered better quality. I think in many cases you could say that the less expensive approach is better quality. But the point I was trying to make is that the incentives are different enough that you may end up with different results. To your point about how disruptive, well, certainly managed care in the 1990s was very disruptive because it was applied in a fairly black and white mechanic. And to be honest, the delivery system, us, we were not ready for it. We were not prepared, other than perhaps Kaiser Permanente, which I think was, the rest of us weren't prepared to appropriately shepherd resources. And I think that created a lot of the backlash. Plus, there was a lot more involvement, direct involvement of insurance companies. I think in the current version, which is very different, similar to the prior, the delivery system is better prepared to do this. The insurers are less interested in being the arm of the law. And I think that actually there is greater potential that we can shepherd resources without compromising care and in many cases improve care.
Yeah, I think we use a lot of words that we have to be clear about, and managed care HMOs are two of those words. One's a word, one's an abbreviation. There's the for-profit world that came into healthcare in the 1990s, and I think took the phrase managed care, but didn't manage any care. It simply put up high roadblocks to keep people from getting care, mm-hmm. and kept the difference in those two outcomes. I think we have a very different situation. You know, I think there's a big difference between the not-for-profit programs, and in some states of the United States, it's illegal actually to have a for-profit health plan. But the not-for-profits, I think, have a very different view of the world, which really says we do best when we keep patients healthiest. We do best when we intervene as quickly as possible and avoid complications. We do best by minimizing the problems that happen in a hospital. You know, one of the things that scares me is that if you look at the typical hospital in the United States, it makes about what's called a 4% margin. If you look in the hospital, 4% of the people who are there because of medical error, pressure sores, central line infections. If they'd avoided developing the complications, they'd be out of business. That kind of conflict leads, I think, to the wrong set of decisions, and the entire system simply needs to be redesigned in a way that's going to, I believe, increase the quality, to in a way that's very patient satisfying, and a way that's going to be more affordable.
Mm-hmm. Victoria Sweet, when you are looking out at the change that's coming, how do you think that how do you think you will manage in the room with the patient?
Well, that's why I'm not in a room with a patient at the moment. No, I really mean that, actually. I'm waiting to see how things kind of fall out, because I find that in the room with the patient, under those stresses, impossible to resolve in a way that feels good to me. So I'm kind of waiting to see how things shake out. I personally have always enjoyed practicing in a situation where I get paid a salary and I don't have to really pay attention. And since I don't really like medications very much and I don't like tests, I just instinctively would rather see the patient more often, which is how I get to slow medicine, which has to do with the efficiency, that it's actually cost-saving for doctors to have more time to spend with patients, because that is how we, in fact, order less things. That so much of what we have to do, if I have 10 minutes with a patient and 7 of them is spent on the new electronic health records and I have 3 minutes to talk to a patient and examine them and reach a diagnosis and conclusion, then I'm going to order a lot of tests, because there's no other way for me to get the right diagnosis.
Except I think this gets back to what Robert Pearl was saying, is that we need to completely transform the way we're delivering that care. So if instead of the patient coming to you with out of control blood sugar, that there's, and I see people nodding heads, that a lot of things have happened before that patient mm-hmm. ever gets to you, mm-hmm. so that your role becomes very different and maybe more part of a team, maybe more team oriented. I'm just speculating here.
I'm a bit of an iconoclast here, I think, mm-hmm. in that usually when people come to me, it's not just that their sugar's out of control. They'll just come, right? And they've seen a whole bunch of people, and they've got bunches of tests all over the place, and they've seen, and they have a list of diagnoses and a list of medications, and that's the person. That is what I have to deal with. And my experience is if I personally have enough time to spend with that patient and to track everything down, I can kind of re-get everything together and sort of reorganize it. And from that point, some of these issues, some of these things would be mm-hmm. a good segue. But I don't think we're going to be able to reorganize care. I mean, I have to say that I think Kaiser does a fantastic job of doing what they do. And I think they do it very, very well. And it may be that we should just give the whole system to Kaiser and let them do it. I've thought about that. I honestly haven't. He doesn't know this about me.
We actually have a question like that.
There you go.
I just want to acknowledge the person from the audience. But Josh Adler, you seem to want to. You might not want to give over the whole system
to
Kaiser.
I don't think we're prepared to give the whole system to Kaiser. But I would agree that what Kaiser has done is really groundbreaking, and the results speak for themselves. I do think, and I will speak, you know, somewhat parochially, that what universities bring to the pie is really pushing the bounds of where does the next great thing that might happen. You know, whether it's transplanting organs, whether it's, you know, genomic medicine, whether it's an innovative way to do nothing with better outcomes. The universities, you know, do have a role to create that innovation and that exploration. And so I think at least my job, I think, is safe for a little while longer, although it may not be. But I did want to comment on one thing, and that has to do with, you mentioned teams. And I think that that's a very important point. Because one of the places we're stuck in American medicine is that we link all interventions to the visit with a doctor. And the visit with a doctor is, one, often inconvenient for patients, two, often expensive, and increasingly with the Affordable Care Act, unavailable if the only way to get care is a visit with a doctor, if we have 30 million more people with access to health care. So one of the things around teams has to do with bringing other people into the tent who are highly capable to provide care. And whether this is nurse practitioners or pharmacists or medical assistants or RNs, what have you, all of those professionals are highly trained. And they actually have very important contributions to make, many times beyond the talents of a physician. And we have a lot of work to do to allow those groups of people to practice at the top of their license. And in many states, that's not possible now.
I would also ask, are doctors behaving ethically when they organize against efforts to, say, allow nurse practitioners to practice at the top of their license?
You're really trying to get me in trouble.
Oh, no, no, I'm just asking a broad question here.
I think it's wrong. I think certain physician groups have it wrong, that protecting sort of the care of patients only within the realm of physicians is a bad strategy for the United States.
I have a question here that was actually percolating in my mind too, a question from the audience. Does stewardship of resources necessarily imply rationing of resources, which patients, that's the question, and then which patients then hear as, I will not get the health care that I need and deserve, but as has been pointed out, we also have a big problem with patient safety in this country. Maybe the best thing is to do less for certain people. But Robert Pearl, I would say, is there enough money in the system to actually treat patients in an ethical manner, you know, fairly, ethically?
Yeah, I think the word stewardship has nothing to do with rationing. I think stewardship says, I have an expertise, I trained in medical school and I did my residency, and you're entrusting yourself into my hands because I have this additional training, and I'm just going to be a steward to you. Now, I can fail to do that stewardship well. I can do it for my own personal interest as opposed to yours. But I believe that there's plenty of money in order to be able to do. We know, compared to other countries, that we spend a lot of money without getting a lot more improvement. We have a lot of examples of how those dollars are misused. And I go back to what I said at the beginning, prevention. We do a poor job of prevention in the United States. And I often, you know, from an ethical point of view, I talk about the fact that if someone goes to an orthopedic surgeon and has surgery and has a complication and dies, we call that a major complication, which it is. But if a woman goes to an orthopedic surgeon, has that on a mammogram, and dies of breast cancer, we don't think of that in medicine as a complication. We still have a mother who's dead, a child who's motherless, a spouse who's not there. And to me, it's just as significant that we've not been good stewards of that. You look at the data across the United States. We don't do all the things around prevention. I'll give you another good example of that. In the United States today, if you're hospitalized on a Friday night, you're going to spend an extra day in the hospital compared to a Tuesday night. Same diagnosis, same problem. You just got sick on Friday instead of on Tuesday. That's not good stewardship for your resources.
I will say that actually happened to a friend of mine, and I blocked it.
Happens to everyone.
So.
You're going to spend an extra day getting better. Is that ethical? You're going to have the risk of getting complications. Is that ethical? Everything about it, to me, is unethical. And if I'm a good steward, I try to get you better as fast as possible. And I think a lot of those opportunities exist in American society today.
We have some questions also from the audience about specifically, which I think flows right into this next question, is about end-of-life care. And, you know, we had on the one side, during the debate about the Affordable Care Act, this fear of death panels. And yet on the other side, I think we have patients who are, and families who are just frightfully concerned that they will die a highly medicalized death. Victoria Sweet, when you think about talking to patients about end-of-life care, how do you deal on both sides with either a fear of death panels or this fear on the other side, or even then, is the patient ethically obligated to have a conversation? Many people want to have the conversation. Mm-hmm. Many people do not.
Well, we're here in San Francisco now, and I have to say that in Northern California, this has been worked out pretty well. What do I mean by that? Well, we've gotten used to talking about this, and if anybody here hasn't yet talked to their person about what they want, then they need to do that. Because that is the biggest problem I've had as a doctor, is getting somebody who they either don't have a significant other, or the person comes in and they've never spoken about it. So I think you are obligated to talk to your people and think it through. Because if they know what you would want, because what happens is if you become incapacitated and can't say what you want, then somebody's going to say it for you. So if you have somebody, do that. Write it down. I myself wrote it down. I wrote a letter. Because even if you say, oh, well, you know, if I'm comatose, I don't want this or that, by the time they open up, you know, they look at those directives, then there may be a whole new sheaf of technologies that you forgot to say don't do that or do that. So something about who you are as a person and how you value freedom, lack of pain, life, so that it's clear if somebody can just read that. Because what happens if you don't have that is we have to do the best job we can. And right now, the default value is that you would want everything done if you haven't said you don't want everything done. Now, a lot of times at Laguna Honda, we had this actually very well worked out. And, you know, to me, the golden rule, what would I want done if I were that person, is a nice rule to use, but we really can't use it. So that's kind of, I have not seen any more. 20 years ago, we used to see somebody had advanced life directives. They had something written. They had a surrogate decision maker saying, don't do this, and it was done anyway. I don't think that's the issue anymore. I think it's not having those directives, not having something that tells us what you want. So,
you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our theme tonight is Improving the Ethics and Practice of Medicine. Our panelists are Dr. Robert Pearl, Executive Director and CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Dr. Victoria Sweet, Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and author of the critically acclaimed book, God's Hotel, and Dr. Josh Adler, Chief Medical Officer of UCSF Medical Center and UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital. I'm Lisa Alaferis, Health Editor at KQED News. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. Josh Adler, I would, picking up on what Victoria Sweet was saying, I appreciate your confidence that people in the Bay Area have made their wishes known to their loved ones in advance. I'm a little bit skeptical based on the reporting I've done on this issue. And Josh Adler, I would also question whether there has to be a relation, whether doctors need to bring up this issue to patients who may be reluctant and are waiting for their doctor to bring it up. I mean, some evidence from your own institution shows that elderly patients are waiting for their doctors to ask them.
Yeah, no, there's no question that that although many patients may have an advance directive and maybe have discussed it with a loved one, many haven't. And it's true that physicians do have, I believe, an ethical responsibility, although I wouldn't limit it to physicians. I think this is any healthcare professional has an ethical responsibility to at least to understand the desires of the patient they're taking care of. So to go a little bit further, it isn't just what happens at the very, very end of life, once someone is perhaps incapacitated or so sick that we're considering an aggressive stay in the intensive care unit or what have you. Where we have much to do in this country has to do with what about the care of someone who's just very, very sick and their quality of life has deteriorated to a great degree, but they're completely able to speak for themselves. Physicians, other healthcare providers, we haven't provided any options. Now, we've done a couple of experiments at UCSF, but maybe I can describe it, that seems like it is shedding some light on where we need to go. We have a program for patients with heart failure, very severe heart disease, and that's a common condition of older individuals, and they're oftentimes hospitalized for heart failure, and in fact, rehospitalized. And what we found was that if we spent the time really trying to understand what they value in their life, many of them, not all, but many of them simply don't want to come into hospital anymore. They just don't want to be there. And understand the consequences. And what that does is it allows the healthcare team to just provide comfort, medications that reduce the sense of air hunger or breathlessness or make it easier to sleep, which might not have been used previously. But the amazing thing is that those patients lived longer than the people who kept coming back to the hospital to get the aggressive care. So there is a really important lesson there that I think goes beyond even this notion of, you know, what happens at the very, very end of life.
While you're looking at that, let me comment on that. Because I want to go a step behind that. I think what you're saying, Josh, is very relevant. Doctors don't tell patients the truth. And what you're describing is telling the patient the truth. Here's what's happening in your life. And here, I can't predict the future. I'm not a seer, but I can give you a good sense because I've taken care of hundreds of patients with heart failure. And here's what it's likely to mean. And here are some options. And what would you like? Here's the cancer that you have. Here's the consequence of that. You've been hospitalized 5 times with a particular problem. You're going to be rehospitalized 2x next year, probably. This is the truth, to the best of my medical knowledge. Now I want to give you true informed consent. And I think that particularly physicians, actually other healthcare providers are better at it than physicians. Physicians are very poor at telling patients bad news and telling them the truth and then trusting the patient. Patients are much stronger than we as doctors believe, and they actually handle the truth well. And once we provide that, provide support to them, I think they'll make the right decisions for them. And again, your study was very, very encouraging because you're absolutely right. Once people feel that they have control, they're not victims, they have control, they live longer and live better.
It's interesting you say the right decision because I actually would challenge that a little bit because we're seeing a big movement in shared decision making. And it could be that a patient and a doctor may not know. I mean, maybe there is no right decision. There's what the patient wants, which may be in conflict with what the doctor thinks is the right decision.
Oh, by right decision, I meant what the patient wants. That's okay. The person who it is. Okay. As a doctor, don't know what you want until I ask you. And I've got to educate you first. And once I explain what you have and explain the options to you in the most honest way I can, you'll make the right choice for yourself or the best choice for yourself.
So along those lines, we have a question here, Victoria Sweet, for you from the audience. You spoke of your responsibility to work to heal a patient's illness. But as we've been talking about, it's sometimes people can't be healed. So how has this new emphasis on simply keeping a patient well changed your ethical responsibilities and your own ethical decisions?
Could you read that again?
So,
not really.
I think you talked about healing patients.
I don't think I did, but we have this. The only reason I just say that is I don't usually think about healing a patient.
No, interesting. Okay.
I just don't. It's not a concept I would normally use. Maybe I did say that. I'm not saying I didn't, but
okay.
Taking care of a patient, yes.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm just a little puzzled. Go ahead.
Okay. So Maybe the audience question simply means the new emphasis on keeping patients well.
I think that's
has that changed your ethical responsibilities?
Well, it's brought up something that we don't talk about very much, which I think is the ethical responsibility of patients. I can't do anything to make you well. And there's this whole very interesting thing that's happened with this confusion, I think, part of this whole thing with stewardship, the confusion between public health and private health and private health and wellness and illness. I'm educated to take care of you when you get sick, and I'm pretty good at it. Not getting sick or doing the things that it takes to keep well, I wish I could do something about it. But really, there's a few things that we know. They're just relentless. We know what it takes. We know the contribution we can make. The way I look at it is there's three things. There's your genetics, your environment, and your luck. There's not a whole lot you can do about genetics, and there's not a whole lot you can do about luck. So that leaves your personal environment. And within that, I happen to think the most important things are your temperament, really. And basically, people that are happy, people that enjoy life, well, in a way, what difference does it make then? If you're enjoying your day, you're enjoying right now, that's kind of number one. And then we know, you know, I'll tell a little story about I was down visiting my folks, my 90-and-a-half-year-old father, who's planning a trip to the Galapagos in a few years by himself. And speaking of genes, and my 85-and-a-half-year-old mother who said to me, she said, have you looked at what's on the bestseller list? She said, there are 4 books on dieting on the bestseller list. She said, what's wrong with these people? It's easy. She said, if you have enough money, you have enough money to buy pot roast, potatoes, and peas. Don't eat too much, drink a little bit, get enough sleep. What? That's it. That's all I have to say about staying well.
So we have another question here from the audience about the growing e-patient and peer-to-peer healthcare movements. And how can they be more effective? I don't know. Josh Adler, is the truly engaged patient a wonderful thing, a big challenge?
Mostly a wonderful thing. The challenge is that some of the information available to the engaged patient is bogus. And so one of our roles as healthcare providers is to try to sort through the bogus information to try to get to the truth. But I think, to Victoria's point, the engaged patient is the one that actually will be successful trying to stay well. And we as healthcare providers need to provide some guidance on what that takes. We also have to have humility because we individually don't know everything. We hardly know anything. But even the entirety of medical science doesn't know everything. So we as providers have to be far more open when a patient says, I eat this green leaf, I feel fantastic. And I think 15 years ago, I might have said, I don't know what's in that green leaf. There's no data for that. I don't know what you mean by fantastic. I would recommend against it. And now I realize that's completely wrong. You feel fantastic. Let me just make sure that there isn't anything horrible in this leaf, and then you go ahead and take it, because, in fact, it might really be helping you. So the engaged patient is clearly superior. The healthcare industry in general, we have failed, I think, at our opportunity to provide accurate information on the internet, in books, etc. And so we are doing a lot of repair work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd like to pivot for a moment and go directly into the Affordable Care Act and some of the conflicts that have come up that are very important to a lot of patients, and that's the national debate we've seen around requirements that contraceptives be covered, or that we've seen about the so-called morning after pill, and especially about abortion, and the ethics around doctors and healthcare providers of all kinds. Bumping into a patient request that is outside of their own personal ethics And what are doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers' rights to their own moral compass and to their patient? Victoria Sweet, I'd be curious to hear if you've ever, have you had patients tell you something that you think to yourself, I just cannot do that. How do you handle that?
Sure, I don't do it.
And what do you tell the patient?
I don't think it's ethical for me to do that. I don't believe in it. It depends. Be on the, you know, would have to be. I can give you an example. Mm-hmm. The example I would give would be a patient who asks me to give them something that they can kill themselves with. Now, I'm not particularly against euthanasia as long as somebody else does it. Truly, I mean, I'm not against passing a law about it, but I wouldn't do it, and so I would just say no. Now, in that case, it's illegal, but even if it were legal, I would still say no, because it doesn't... I mean, I believe that my patients need to know that I'm an ethical person from the inside out, and that I start with myself and doing what's ethical for me and mine, and you're part of me, and therefore I wouldn't do something I consider not ethical. So even though I'm personally in favor of a woman's right to abortion, I have no problem with that. If somebody else feels as strongly as I do about other things, it feels it's not ethical, then I think they have to... They have to. I mean, what's the opposite? The opposite of saying you have to provide something that you think is unethical. How could we do that?
Well, then we could carrying this to its conclusion. Sure. We could have, you know, people practicing medicine and providing health care any way they want according to their own moral compass. And then, what does the desperate patient do who needs an abortion and has just hit a wall with their doctor? Does the doctor have a right to refer? Is that referral against the doctor's ethics?
I can't comment. I don't know. I mean, I don't have an answer to that. I think there's very different with doing something you think is wrong and not doing something you think is right. I guess that wouldn't really pertain.
Because I'm just looking, I'm going to go out on a limb here and think that a Bay Area audience is probably largely supportive of contraceptives being covered for free by health insurance. Probably not everybody who's listening, but probably the overwhelming majority of people here think that. But there are people in this country who think that insurers should not, that certain people should not be required to pay for that's, Josh Adler, you're nodding. So how do we resolve? That is, I think, a very easy conflict for people to grab a hold of. It's happening right now.
Right.
So
I would sort of separate the coverage decision notion, because my view is that coverage decisions should be based on science, and that not covering contraceptives sort of goes against scientific evidence that prove that this is a valuable medical therapy. I think to your point about what should an individual doctor be required to provide a service that they personally believe is unethical. I think I would agree that the answer is no, that you can't ask individuals to do something they think is unethical. But I do think we have a responsibility to then help that patient find someone who will. And in fact, that is our own internal policy, that if you don't personally feel comfortable with a particular request, that is okay. But you then have the duty to help that patient find out how they can get that service.
Robert Pearl, this must be something you have systems for at Kaiser.
So I'd go back to where you started the first question. I think it's an important point not to miss, which is that 30 million, 34 million uninsured is unethical. And we have to start with that. From my belief, it's a basic right. We know it defines not only health but happiness, life, a lot of other positive aspects that I think are just fundamental to who we are, both as people and as American citizens. And so I want to start with the fact that the bill, I think, solved an ethical problem, which was providing coverage to 34 million more people. I think the second thing I'd say about it, though, is that there's still a second ethical issue, which is that it didn't address the issue of affordability, which is going to become the next problem that we're going to have to take on, as I said, on an ethical standpoint. I think we often in the bill get lost in a lot of the details around the edges that sit in place. But I would say, you know, I agree with Josh that as individual physicians, we shouldn't be violating our ethics. And yet at the same time, we have to make sure that we don't abandon our patients. And so to that extent, part of our job is to make sure we're able to provide for them those things that may go against our individual. I think you have to separate, though, ethics and legal. And that's where the challenge often is. Some things that are illegal is very different than some things that are unethical. So it's complex and I think very specific to the individual matter. But overall, my belief is I'm a big believer that patients deserve to be able to get those things that they want, that they believe will increase their health. And we as a society, we as physicians, we as individual physicians, have a moral and ethical obligation to do the best we can, whether it's from the economic perspective, the quality perspective, the prevention perspective, or the coverage perspective.
We have an interesting question from the audience. What are the ethics of weighing the short term, which in the medical context may be urgent, versus the long term? Are there any heuristics for integrating these, as well as complex interacting concerns in general? So weighing short term urgent outcomes versus the long term. Josh Adler?
I have to look up the word heuristic for just a second.
I had to think about that too.
But I can let me give that a try. The whole notion of the short term, the urgent, the emergent, sort of the emergency department being sort of a symbol of the short term, and how is that weighed against, for example, the long term wellness of a population? And I'd say we struggle with this as a society. We grew up as a healthcare delivery system, really as an injury and illness treatment system, which was very much all about the short term, because there was no even concept of long term. There wasn't chronic illness or chronic disability. At least it wasn't recognized. And as we have built the system to deal with the chronic, we have in some cases overwhelmed the short term resources. So if you look at emergency departments in California, what you see is massive overcrowding, much of it with chronic long-term illness issues, in many ways crowding out the smaller number of truly emergent issues. And I think it's a very good question, and I'm not giving much of an answer other than to describe it a little bit more. But I think we have not solved this. And in fact, we've essentially forced our interest in improving the long-term view of health into a system that was designed physically to deliver short-term. And that's part of the redesign, I think, that Dr. Pearl has mentioned several times. We actually need a really good short-term emergency system to deal with just emergencies, and we need to move everything that doesn't belong there out. And we haven't done that yet.
Mm-hmm. Victoria Sweet, you're nodding in agreement here.
Yeah, this is great. I think it was a very hard question, and I think it was a great and really clear answer. And I would actually toss it now to Dr. Pearl, because Kaiser has, the way I understand Kaiser is it's got an advantage in that many of its patients are working individuals, so they tend to be more in a well than a chronically ill category. But there's this whole, you've had a whole thing around how you're going to make people well-er and less ill, yes?
Yeah. So going back 60 years, the founder of the medical group, Dr. Garfield, talked about we need a health plan, not a sick plan. And I think that's been a fundamental belief that sits underlying it all. Obviously, in an emergency, you're going to take care of the sickest people first. I mean, that's built into our obligation as physicians to save lives. But I think that's an emergency. An emergency shouldn't happen very often. And I'll give one example. You know, we have a lot of focus on hypertension control. And we have the ability to have 87% of our patients with hypertension well controlled as opposed to a national average of 55. The difference between those two numbers is a 40% lower chance of a patient developing a stroke. I think having patients develop strokes where they didn't have to is a ethically problematic area. We failed as doctors, but American medicine doesn't see it that way. We think of stroke as this thing that sort of happens and we couldn't do anything about it and it was really no one's fault. And so to the extent of first do no harm, we might have done harm when we didn't intervene. And I think changing that whole ethical view, the idea of stewardship, the ability to prevent the disease in the first place, rather than waiting for it to come in to treat it, that's part of the answer to the emergency problem. A lot of people in the emergency department have heart attacks and strokes they didn't have to have. But we failed as a society. We failed as a medical profession. And I think ethics should be the driving force underlying it.
And then along those lines, people are starting to talk a lot now, especially with the Affordable Care Act, having a provision that smokers can be charged more for their health insurance. Do patients have there will be carrots within the, and maybe sticks within, you know, wellness programs that are run by employers. Do patients have an ethical responsibility to try and live more healthy lives? Victoria Sweet, what do you think? What do you think of that? You have dealt in your career with some people who have real challenges maybe to trying to live a healthy life.
Yeah, but those, they're not going to respond to carrots or sticks. There's part of it, we have these different populations, and I think we just have to accept that there's a certain percentage of people, the 3% I would deal with at Laguna Honda, that are just pretty much, they don't respond to carrots and sticks. So I can't imagine a world in which we didn't have a small percentage of people that just lived their lives without looking into the future. I don't think we can really change that too much, maybe 3% to 2.9%. But there's no question that, you know, prevention is the best, you know, the best cure. So I don't think anybody would disagree with that. The only caveat I would say, and that, again, I always kind of think on the wrong side of a situation, and that is that then when we've looked at people who do take all their medications, we don't find they do all that much better. And in a way, that goes back to what you were alluding to, Josh, that when you follow this protocol of admitting people over and over again for their CHF, which is what you were supposed to do, and then didn't admit them, and that wasn't what you were supposed to do, they actually did better. So there's a little bit of worry in the back of my head that with insurance companies making the carrots to do all these things we're supposed to do now that we believe we're supposed to do, we're going to actually not end up with such a much of a better outcome. And what I look at is old menus from Laguna Honda. So Laguna Honda was made in the 1860s. People saved a ton. And there was a menu, and this was supposed to be a good menu. This was supposed to be a healthy menu. And it starts out with beef stew in the morning, beef stew at lunch, and toast and tea in the evening, and at 11 and 4, 4 ounces of whiskey. Really? This was healthy. And so I'm a little bit concerned that our general assumption that we absolutely know exactly what blood pressure to get people to, and now we just had a study showing that the lowest blood pressure isn't the best. There's studies about cholesterol and primary prevention that show it's not all that great to have a low cholesterol. In fact, it's not even all that good to have a normal cholesterol that's coming out of Europe. These are things that worry me. They worry me. They worry me from an ethical perspective that when I do get back into a situation that I'm going to be required to get everybody's blood pressure, everybody's cholesterol, when in fact I don't believe that that's necessarily the right numbers to be headed towards.
So unfortunately we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. But Josh Adler, you really seemed like you wanted to add something.
Well, I was
here.
Just going to say, I think there are elements where it is actually ethically appropriate, and they have to do really with behaviors and not so much with health care. Mm. So smoking. Mm-hmm. There's no debate that smoking is bad. It's highly addictive and very difficult to quit. But smokers consume inordinate resources in the healthcare system. So having people quit smoking, whatever incentives work, we should do them, including the carrots and stick. Exercise would probably be another one where those would be appropriate. And if you look at places that have tried it, Safeway, for its own employees, it works. Their employees are healthier because they have incentivized their health plan so that if they don't smoke or they quit smoking or they exercise more, they pay less.
So I do want to honor this last question here, which is you mentioned Robert Pearl. You know, you pointed out that the Affordable Care Act is expanding coverage to all the uninsured. And yet there's this tremendous concern among the haves that they will somehow be, there's a concern among them that they will be impacted negatively, that this will make it harder for them to access their own health care. What's your view, I guess, what's your view going forward when we look at the implementation of the Affordable Care Act coming January 1st?
So my prediction is that people will have coverage and that the other problems will grow because the fundamental redesign won't change. And I think the United States will now go through a period of ethical debate about how to make that happen. I'm hoping that patients will actually lead that process, demanding that they be able to get prevention, that they be able to get the kind of care that they get. We didn't talk about some of the technological options, that they have options, access to that. There's a broad way that American medicine is stuck in the 19th century and has to move into the 21st century. And to me, that's an ethical issue. It's just not going to get resolved on January 1st of 2014. I think it will be an evolution in our society over probably a 5 to 10 year period.
Victoria Sweet, a couple of closing comments as you look toward January 1st.
Oh, well, don't get me started, because I actually read that whole thing. And it's going to be very interesting. I mean, I think there's great things in it, and then there's a whole lot in it. I don't know how it's going to work out. Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a bumpy ride, but we are on the right path. And so our desire is to stay on this path until we get it right.
All right, then. And we're going to wrap up now. Our thanks to Dr. Robert Pearl, Executive Director and CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Dr. Victoria Sweet, Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and author of the critically acclaimed book, God's Hotel, and Dr. Josh Adler, Chief Medical Officer of UCSF Medical Center and UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital. We also thank our audience here as well as on radio and television. Tonight's program has been part of the club's series in Ethics and Accountability, underwritten by the Charles Travers family. This program has also been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Health and Medicine Forum. We'd also like to remind you that copies of Dr. Victoria Sweet's book are on sale in the lobby, and she'll be pleased to sign them in this room following the program. I'm Lisa Alaferis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.